Yet another Monday on Issues, Etc. A Monday that brings news in the form of, well, at least last week. This is a little late in its news, but people have been mulling this over. The Oscar nominations are right there in last week's Everyday section. And I'm surprised that the, at least it seems to me, for the Oscar nominations, the pickings are so slim. Maybe there haven't been enough movies, maybe not kind of Oscar-quality movies. We'll talk about the Oscar nominations in the first hour of Issues, Etc. today with Brian Gadawa. He's a screenwriter from Southern California, and he'll join us here in just a minute. A little later in the program, in the second hour, we're going to be talking with the author of our Issues, Etc. book of the month, Testing the Claims of Church Growth, Pastor Rod Zwanitzer. This will be part three of a series that we've been doing with him on this Issues, Etc. book of the month for February. We're talking in general about the church growth movement, but today we will focus in the second hour of the program on the pastor's role in evangelism. Is the pastor a CEO? Is he kind of a corporate therapist? Is he a coach? Is he a cheerleader? It seems if you looked in the congregations of American evangelicalism today, you might get the sense that there's a bit of an identity crisis about who and what the pastor is supposed to be doing in church. We'll talk about that in the second hour of Issues, Etc. The third hour is open lines for your questions and your comments. By the way, for those who were not able to call last week because of our phone problems, you can call during these 3 hours beginning today, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Open lines is the third hour of the program. We'll talk a little bit about how lights and cameras and sound systems have taken on a whole new role in the worship life of the church, following up on our conversation on the church growth movement with Pastor Rod Zwanitzer, and a couple other things to share with you, an update on the Estrada filibuster, and what else is there here? There's all sorts of good stuff. Oh, yes, the ecumenical movement and the anti-war protests. You probably were surprised on Saturday to see the scope of the anti-war protests. Martin Marty answers this question on BeliefNet.com. What would Luther do? We've got WWJD. This is WWLD. What would Luther do if faced with the Iraqi crisis? We'll talk about that during the third hour of Issues, Etc. Open lines. Brian Gadawa is a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Movies with Wisdom and Discernment. Brian, welcome back.
Hey, Todd. Great to be here.
Do you share my sense that that at least as far as the Oscar nominations went, that it was kind of slim pickings? It was not a lot to choose from this time around?
Yeah, definitely. Although I went through my list of movies that I'd seen through the year, and I definitely found a few options that I thought were quite a bit better than the ones they chose for Best Picture, at least some of them, you know.
Let's start with Best Picture. Who came out on top as far as nominations go?
Well, I think it was Chicago. I think they had like 13 nominations, which was, you know, sort of a surprise coming out of you know, as a musical and such. You know, people wouldn't normally think of that to do so well. But I did see it. It really was a good movie, actually. It was really well done, and I hate musicals. So I went there expecting to walk out in the first 15 minutes, but I ended up staying. I ended up really liking the movie. Whether or not it deserved to be Best Picture, I don't know. I don't think so.
So Chicago was not as insufferable as Moulin Rouge.
Oh, no. For me, Moulin Rouge was totally insufferable, but Chicago had a really had a great, strong moral to it, and it also had you know, the dancing and the singing. Again, I hate musicals, so it would have to be very, very interesting and unique singing that would interest me to stay, and it did. And they also did something that is really hard to do, and that is integrate the music into the storyline. Oftentimes when you see a musical, the story stops when the song begins and the story picks up again when the song ends. And that is a difficult thing to overcome. But in Chicago, they really did a great job of integrating the songs into the storyline. I think that's what really made it the pacing a lot better.
Now, this is the movie with Richard Gere, his wife, and Renee Zellweger, right?
Richard Gere's wife? Who's that?
I thought his wife was in this one.
Not that I know.
Perhaps not. I was mistaken.
I don't know who he's married to, but it's Catherine Zeta-Jones and... Oops, sorry, my goofy phone there. Catherine Zeta-Jones and Renee Zellweger were the lead women in that.
And now, you said that, I mean, musicals are kind of notoriously low on story, but what is the story here in Chicago?
Well, the story is basically about Renee Zellweger, who's basically she just loves vaudeville and would love to be a dancer and singer on the stage, and so she dreams of it, and she looks up to Catherine Zeta-Jones' character, who plays in these lounges and sleazy nightclubs. And basically what happens is that Renee has an adulterous affair with a man who promises her to help her career, and he doesn't end up doing it, so she kills him in a fit of passion. And then she goes to jail, and in jail she meets other women who've also killed their spouses or their boyfriends for any one of a various number of reasons. It's pretty much like Michael Medved said, it's pretty much a feminist dream world, you know, the women killing all the men and the like. But really, I think the movie goes deeper than that, and it deals with the how people justify their crimes, how people... It's really a satire. The movie is a satire of our culture and how the culture heroifies and deifies criminals because of just the sensationalist nature of it, and how we breed criminals in our midst because of that. And it's also another satirical look at the nature of how people try to avoid culpability for their crimes, personal moral responsibility. It's very timely in the O.J. era. This movie comes out, even though the original version of it was done many years ago. I think it's very appropriate for today.
Does it say something to you, as someone who watches these things, Brian, that in an era of very serious geopolitical, international politics, war-making, things like that, that the highest recipient of nominations for the Oscars is a musical that is essentially a very lighthearted genre, kind of fantasy genre?
Yeah, well, again, like I say, though, I think the story is not lighthearted. It's very dark, actually. It's a dark comedy almost. It's a satire, you know. And so, it's not that light. It really isn't. but that's one of the reasons why I liked it. I mean, it really does have a serious edge to it. In fact, I wrote a review for it or an analysis for it on the Chalcedon Foundation website there. Sorry about the phone. I can't fix that. I just got a problem with that I can't fix. So, like I said, it's not entirely offensive to me. It really isn't. Whether or not it deserves the Best Picture of the Year, when the likes of Lord of the Rings was out and some other movies like, you know, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, Road to Perdition, and other movies that didn't get nominated, I question it a little bit, but not as much as I question other movies like The Abysmal Gangs of New York and the movie The Hours.
Now, you mentioned three that were right on the top of my mind when it came to what didn't, the dog that didn't bark. And that is, first and foremost, The Lord of the Rings, the second part, came out huge box office. Why no nominations, especially given the fact that, you know, most people recognize the acting in these things is impeccable.
And, you know, and Peter Jackson didn't even get a nomination for Best Director, which is really a crime, in my opinion, you know. I mean, you know, he better get it by the third one. My gosh, I think he should have got it for the first one. But, you know, all I can say is I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of politics that go on in all these choices, unfortunately. And it's not always really, it's driven by a lot of politics. So why, I don't really know. But, and especially since the second one really does have a, you know, it even has some political correctness in it, you know, with the whole pro-environmental message and the like. I would think that would have helped it with Hollywood, you know. So I don't know. I don't know why. And plus, this one, I think, in some ways, is a much richer, deeper film than The Fellowship, the first movie, because with the addition of Gollum, we're brought into a lot more character contradictions and struggles than were even in the first one, which makes it a richer film.
Do you think that there's just a marvelous little scene in the Two Towers? And you mentioned Gollum, the character, who's a CGI character, computer generated in an amazing way. There's a scene there that I think should have probably got Best Actor when he's arguing with himself.
Oh, absolutely.
But you can't really nominate a CGI character for Best Actor.
Well, that was one of the things that people were mentioning, though, that it was very possible that he could have got. I think he should have gotten nomination for a Best Supporting Actor, because even though the character is CGI'd, he acted the whole thing and he did the words as well. He spoke the words as the character. So I really think he should have. I really do.
The other one you mentioned was Road to Perdition. What was that movie about, and why do you think it was overlooked?
Well, Road to Perdition was a movie that starred Tom Hanks, and it was basically a gangster movie. You know, it's sort of on the level of Godfather Part Two or so. Yeah, I think Godfather Part Two. And you know, it's about a man who's caught up in the mobster land in Chicago, and his son gets embroiled in it, and the pursuit of the movie is this father trying to escape being killed, at the same time trying to figure out a way to get his son, break his son out of the lifestyle of crime that he is inevitably going to get sucked into. So it's really a story about redemption, actually, a very strong story of redemption, while also being, you know, rather violent and the like. But again, nothing any different from like Godfather or any of those movies.
So does Tom Hanks just have too many Oscars to give him another nomination?
I don't know. But, you know, he would have deserved it. In my opinion, he would have deserved a Best Actor, and the movie should deserve at least being up for Best Picture, because the thing about choosing the Best Pictures, I think as you look over the kinds of movies that get nominated and what win, they usually tend to be epics of some kind, or at least something that deals with a deep, heavy theme. You know, you're not going to see too many comedies or too many action movies or anything like that throughout the years. They're usually long epics, and I think that's one of the reasons why Gangs of New York is up there, because it's this big, sprawling epic, as abysmally horrid as it is, but it still is, and so it gets nominated. But Road to Perdition has all that. It's a big epic. It's epic in terms of its content, what it's dealing with, redemption versus the cycle of violence and the sins of the father being visited on the sons, you know. And it's got a real strong drive to it in a hero that's very grand. It's a very grand hero piece. So that's why I think it really deserved to be on there. Of course, I think We Were Soldiers was 2002 as well. That was another movie that I thought really deserved to be up there, at least for a nomination of Best Picture. But, of course, because it's a primarily war picture, the movie is only about the battles, almost, that occur in there. I think that, although it's about much more than that, I think that it probably just got snubbed because it was just too much of a war movie.
And why did My Big Fat Greek Wedding get snubbed, in your opinion?
Because
it made a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think it may have to do with the fact that it was a romantic comedy, and they just find it hard. Nothing wrong with having romantic interest in these nominations, but I think that that's probably it. It's just so hard to break through that barrier, but I think it deserved to be up there for Best Picture because it was so rich and so deep and full, much beyond the comedy, and that's one of the reasons what made it such a big hit, you know. But I think that's one of the big problems is breaking through that comedy barrier.
Speaking of romance, maybe not so much of the kind of lighthearted comedy, there is, for Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Supporting Actor, in the person of Kathy Bates, About Schmidt. My parents, both of them retirement age, loved this movie. What's it about?
Yeah, that's another movie that I thought, rather than The Hours, should have gotten nominated. About Schmidt is a story of Jack Nicholson, who plays a man at the end of his life, you know, just retired from his job, and basically he realizes that his life has meant nothing, he's made no difference, and his life is near over now, and he's realizing the full weight of the meaninglessness of his life. And so he goes on a road trip to try to stop his daughter from marrying what seems to him to be a hick and a buffoon. It's all about it. It's sort of like a little road trip of his life, you know. And I think it's a very powerful film that touches the deep issues in our life. It asks all the right questions about what is our life really about? What's valuable in life? Have we wasted it? Have we spent our life squandering our life away in our boring, meaningless jobs and living our meaningless lives, you know, and petty lives and such? So I think it's a really profound film in that sense. I really loved it.
My dad and mom went to see this when it came out. My dad, who usually talks to me about the weather, about the latest book he's read, those kind of things on the telephone, spent about 25 minutes telling me about Schmidt.
Yeah.
After he had seen it, made such a deep impression on him. One reviewer I heard said that Jack Nicholson's performance in this is perhaps the best of his career.
Yeah, I would agree. Probably because it was a very understated role. So he had to really play a character that's going through a deep inner struggle and trying to show that without saying much, you know. Had some great narration throughout the film where it does reveal his thoughts about his life and what he's done with it. And, yeah, I definitely agree. It's probably one of the best of his life, definitely.
You mentioned before Gangs of New York with a little bit of a derision in your voice. Of course, it got Best Picture nomination, and Daniel Day-Lewis, one of the actors, also got Best Actor nominations as well. Tell us about the film. I take it you don't think it deserves either of these.
Well, Daniel Day-Lewis deserves to win by a long shot. Not that anybody else doesn't either. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I thought, Adrian Brody did a great job. Jack Nicholson did a great job. So did Michael Caine in The Quiet American and Nicolas Cage. Well, Nicolas Cage is always really good. I don't know if he deserved it for adaptation. But anyway, I do think Daniel Day-Lewis deserves to win of the nominees that made it. And however, the rest of the movie was just abysmal, in my opinion. It's just this long, drawn-out, you know, story that's just rambling and the ending is just terrible. This shoddy depiction of the riots of New York, and it's just really sort of boring and uninteresting too. That was my opinion of it. But Daniel Day-Lewis was brilliant as this wicked villain in this story.
And Leonardo DiCaprio, a lot of people expected him to get the spotlight for that film since he is arguably its biggest star.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad he didn't. I mean, he was good, but anything special, you know. So it's basically the story of this young kid who wants to get revenge on his father, who was killed by Daniel Day-Lewis earlier in his life. And it's the story of how, in America during the, I can't remember what era it was, the 1800s or so, when New York was just young and gangs basically ruled the streets, and this gang leader killed DiCaprio's father. So he wants to get revenge. And that's the other thing about the whole story is it's a revenge story. And it's a revenge story that basically ends up justifying revenge at the end, which is a very terrible moral. You know, at least in Road to Perdition, the movie, though not perfect and though in itself tries to get a little bit of the revenge angle in, it deals with revenge, but it ultimately does try to deal with the issue of, you know, you've got to stop the cycle of violence, and you're not going to stop it by pursuing more violence. But Gangs of New York just really perpetuates that problem.
Another Best Picture nominee, The Hours. I have to admit, as much as I watch movies, this one was a sleeper as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, now, again, though, you know, in terms of the actresses in there, I thought all the actresses deserved best actress in a leading role. And I guess Nicole Kidman and Julianne Moore, oh, no, not for that movie, but Nicole Kidman got one for it.
Julianne Moore got Best Supporting Actress.
Yes. But they were all brilliantly acted. They're my favorite actresses anyway, so they were great. Problem was, it's just an agenda-driven movie. It's a homosexual agenda-driven movie. And the story is about three women in three different eras, and it sort of cuts between them. One is Nicole Kidman plays Virginia Woolf, and the other two women play women who, you know, just in different struggles in their lives. And basically, each of them are struggling with, in different ways, being, quote, oppressed by the society and morals around them. And, of course, the monster of the movie, in my opinion, really was Julianne Moore. And she's this woman who, you know, because of her homosexual desires, she leaves her family, her loving husband and, you know, needy son. She just leaves them up and leaves because it was just squelching to her, and she needed life, and that was death to her. And so she destroys their lives because of it, and the movie justifies it at the end that she has to do this. And, you know, the other women also struggle with varying oppressions in the society they live in. And like I said, there's homosexual undertones and agenda that go throughout the whole picture. And it really sort of makes you really have a sour taste in your mouth watching the movie. As great as the acting is, it doesn't justify, you know, this just depraved sort of morality to it.
When you say agenda-driven movie, this is something that I know in many conversations with you, you have a real disdain for. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, you know, where you see that the theme of the movie does not, when a movie doesn't have balance in terms of trying, every movie is going to have a theme, every movie is going to have a point or a moral, it's going to take a stand on what's right and what's wrong. There's nothing wrong with that, and sometimes we just disagree with it. But when a movie is imbalanced, where it only shows one side t- to the extreme, and it shows the opposing view as all, you know, grotesque caricatures or stereotypes of characters, like, you know, the cruel husband, or, you know, whatever, just, or the male society that's oppressing women and all this. When it only shows the one side and it doesn't show the balance, and then you see that it's an imbalanced propaganda-oriented story. Or if you see that, like in The Hours, where, you know, pretty much every story had this homosexual angle to it, that it was trying to bring out the oppression upon those characters in life and from the society around them. And there were other movies like that this year as well, including the one with Dennis Quaid, Far From Heaven, another story very similar, where it just tries to show that people who choose different sexual preferences in this world, they don't fit in with this world because they're rejected, and we're supposed to feel sorry for them, rather than, you know, addressing the issue from a moral issue, and maybe what they're doing is actually, maybe their behavior is actually wrong. And it shows, usually will show those who disagree with that lifestyle to be cruel or evil or wicked, or at least it shows that they're oppressed in this society, you know. So, you know, and that movie in particular had a lot of that in it. So there was not real a balance of any other viewpoints in the story. And even like I said, even if a movie takes a stand on a viewpoint, if it's going to have some integrity and be good art, you're going to try to show a little bit of opposing viewpoints to show the legitimacy of them, even if you don't agree with them.
Ed Harris, we've got about a minute and a half here. Ed Harris is up for Best Supporting Actor in that film, The Hours. What role did he play, and what did you think?
He plays a guy who's sick with AIDS, and dying with AIDS, actually, and he ends up committing suicide. By the way, you know, as much as I say about the sexual agenda in The Hours, in a sense, there's a deeper, more serious issue with it, and that is it's a glorification of suicide and death, because it's really a movie that elevates suicide or death as a very noble element. And which really doesn't surprise me in its connection with that certain lifestyle. But nonetheless, he plays a guy with a death wish, and he's got AIDS himself, and he's a poet. And he actually does do a great job in the movie. You know, he's bitter and falling apart and the like. So he does also deserve his nomination as well, I thought.
It's a shame for me, though, Brian, to see, because I think Ed Harris is a compelling actor. I think he doesn't make a lot of bad movies, and even the bad ones he makes, he acts very well in them.
Yeah.
I think he's one of the actors of our generation, along with Tom Hanks and some others as well, but it's a shame to see him lend his considerable skills to kind of such a transparent effort here in The Hours.
Definitely.
We're talking with Brian Godawa, screenwriter in Southern California, author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Movies with Wisdom and Discernment. If you have been perusing the Oscar nominations, be it Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actress, whatever it might be, and you have some thoughts or comments, a movie that you think should have made it in but didn't, or one that did that shouldn't have, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, another actor. Now, he's up for Best Supporting Actor, and in the paper, he's right down at the very bottom, but I think he's another compelling figure. That's Christopher Walken, and he is nominated for Best Supporting Actor in a film that came out late in the year and a lot of people found simply delightful, called Catch Me If You Can. It also starred Leo DiCaprio and Tom Hanks, but Walken got the nomination. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
When the church proclaims the gospel of Jesus Christ in the open marketplace of ideas, is the customer always right? Can we market the Christian gospel? Is it proper for the Christian church to adopt a business model? In our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth, author Rod Zwanitzer says the answer to all these questions is no. You can order Testing the Claims of Church Growth online. Go to our website at issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find a link to Concordia Publishing House. Or call 1-800-325-3040 and ask to receive the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. 1-800-325-3040. Call during regular business hours. Or visit issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and there you'll find information on how to order Testing the Claims of Church Growth.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear about a labor shortage. The focus is on Eastern Europe. The mission agency Operation Mobilization reminds us that Christ's words are true when he said to pray for laborers in the harvest fields. Christians who are reaching gypsies in the Eastern European countries of Hungary, Ukraine, and Romania know many gypsies who want to know more about Jesus Christ. But the problem is there aren't enough Christians to help local pastors and the area missionaries. Short-term and even career-minded missionaries are needed to help develop Christian leaders and ministries for children and youth. Operation Mobilization states that teams are also needed to teach the basics of Christianity. In Eastern Europe, many people can't afford a Bible, so Christians can help supply literature as well. Pray for more Christians to use their skills in needed areas. Learn more by logging on to the website www.usa.om.org. That's usa.om.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Underneath a rotunda of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., underneath, where you can't see the dome, but only the massive pillars supporting the floor on which spectators above are gazing upward, here, original plans called for President George Washington to be buried. He's not. Had he been, our Capitol would have become something other than the place where the goals of democracy are pursued. It would also have become a shrine to a man. Revered men and women, dead and living, can become impediments to new generations pursuing some worthy cause. Enshrined by respect, deserved respect, to be sure, their devotees are tempted to become followers of personalities rather than pursuers of a cause. The same can be true in matters spiritual. Reverence for godly saints and insightful ministers and teachers can deflect our focus from encounter with God, a demanding God, but to the repentant seeker, a forgiving God in Christ. Underneath a rotunda is now an open space, a place where people walk as they pursue the tasks of freedom. May no person of faith obstruct your highest pursuit, God.
Are you familiar with the scripture that says, "And I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication. They will look on me, the one whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child." It's in Zechariah 12. We'll talk about it next time on The Bible Study with Pastor Kevin Parviz. The Bible Study, weekday mornings, 10:05. The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Academy Award nominations, the Oscar nominations, with Brian Gadawa. And we'll be taking your phone calls here in just a second. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Anyone who would like to check out the website for our guest, Brian Gadawa, he has his own. It's Gadawa.com. That's G-O-D-A-W-A.com. Gadawa.com. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Calling from Southern Illinois, Herman is on the line. Herman, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes, thank you for taking my call and listening to your guest discuss these plot lines. It sounds to me like there's a ghostwriter by the name of Friedrich Nietzsche setting up these scripts. And it also further, in my experience, seems to reach back into some of the dramatic writers that have salted the college campuses' drama presentations over the years, like Arthur Miller, Edward Albee, Tennessee Williams, where they use the audience to become an accessory of their kind of inside-out cynical worldview. And it's, you know, I'm not saying they should be censored as such, but I think there comes a point where you look at that and wonder, there's got to be something else. There is the Word of God and the worldview that creates a Christian worldview in contrast to many of these things. And we have a media in Hollywood that seems in this type of groove of the Nietzschean themes that they've tried to set forth in these works. And I think it's gotten tired.
Herman, thank you for the comment. Brian?
Yeah, well said. Well said. I definitely agree. We are living in the result of a Nietzschean age. We are in that age, and that's what postmodernism is, and Nietzsche's the grandfather of it. So I think people need to be aware of that and know more about it so they can recognize it, just like the caller did, definitely.
Are there any films of this last year that would have been up for, or perhaps received some type of a nomination from the Academy, the Academy for Motion
Pictures, Arts and Sciences.
Arts and Sciences, AMPAS, right there under his feet. Are there any of those films that you think buck the trend, this Nietzschean nihilistic postmodern trend?
Well, of course, I do think that Lord of the Rings does, essentially. I mean, even though it deals with a very dark world, it's, of course, focused on true goodness versus true evil. That's clear. I think that there's a place for dark sarcasm like Chicago, where, you know, you reveal the moral depravity of the world around you by showing its insanity and showing its total, it's insanity in a sense. Let's see, some other movies that I thought, well, of course, Big Fat Greek Wedding, again, that's a movie that really celebrated the unique differences of culture without negating them, you know, but yet had fun with them, learned from them, but also pointed out where they might be a little bit off, so you had a real balanced viewpoint there. I do think Road to Perdition was sort of definitely a little bit more in the vein of a Nietzschean approach, even though there was potential redemption there, it wasn't quite as strong as I would have hoped it to be. And again, I also think We Were Soldiers is a good example of showing heroism and courage, dealing with issues that are hard to solve, you know. But also there's another movie, a small movie that was out called Changing Lanes, and it starred Ben Affleck and can't think of the guy's name.
You know, if my board op were sitting across the board, he could tell me this guy's name, because I can never remember his name.
Me neither.
Either. But you're talking about the movie that was kind of the storyline was kind of a happened meeting between two people in the city, and they basically set out to destroy each other's lives.
Exactly. But it's a story that ends up in repentance and forgiveness and a true change of life and a recognition of the morality. And it's even founded a little bit in a Christian religious understanding in the movie.
Samuel L. Jackson.
And of course the movie To End All Wars, written by me, you know, that was a movie that very clearly has a strong redemptive theme to it, but of course it wasn't nominated for anything.
It was Samuel L. Jackson we were trying to
say. Samuel L. Jackson, exactly.
Of course, he also made a movie this year that probably doesn't rank as high. He made Formula 51 as well, which was... Well, I love Samuel L. Jackson, which was just kind of fun gunplay at everyone else's expense.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't even out long enough for me to even get to see it, so I didn't even get to see it.
All right, I mentioned before the break Christopher Walken getting a Best Supporting Actor nomination for this movie. Again, another one my parents just were tickled to talk about, Catch Me If You Can. What's the story of that film?
Well, Catch Me If You Can is a true story based on a true story of a young kid who in the 70s, I think it was, basically started to impersonate a airline pilot for Pan Am, and he ended up becoming very successful at it and could not get caught for many years, and was finally tracked down by this FBI agent played by Tom Hanks. And unfortunately, that's a movie that's sort of lighthearted, but talk about Nietzschean understanding of morality. I mean, morality really becomes pragmatic in this movie and story, that people are basically cheering on for this young kid to get away with his crimes, which is really not a very, very good moral reality. Not only that, but it sort of shows the life, his immoral life of crime being glorious and fun, and the life of the FBI agent being boring and droll, and the life of righteousness, in other words. So in a very real sense, it's really not a very good morality to the story itself, even though it's based on a true story. You can make your twist to any way you want how you're communicating that true story, and their twist was to really glorify the life of crime. And Christopher Walken in it plays the father, who's sort of the source of this kid's problem, in that he's a coddler who never really challenged his son to be good or to do good, and himself was sort of a weasel. And so his son sort of grows up, and the father refuses to turn the son in. But Christopher Walken does give a great performance throughout the story that's very worthy of the actor in supporting role. But I do think Paul Newman, myself, I think he deserves it for Road to Perdition because he just plays a brilliant, bitter, old-time mafiosa guy who has a very dark side to his reality. And also another story where it shows that the sins of the father are visited on the sons, but in a positive, in a negative sense, meaning, you know, whereas Catch Me If You Can sort of has fun with it and you cheer them on, in Road to Perdition you see that it's not a good thing, that fathers need to do what's right, and their sons need to break the cycle that comes, you know, from their generational, you know, parentage.
Roman Polanski, a big director, is up for Best Director for The Pianist. It's also up. It's the last one on the list for Best Picture. Tell us about the film.
Yeah, The Pianist was a really good movie. I saw it. It was a little long, but it's pretty much like a Schindler's List, you know, sort of where it's the story of literally a pianist who, it's his story of survival in Poland, beginning with the Warsaw Ghetto, where the Nazis basically invade Poland, then they turn Warsaw into a ghetto. And he lives through that, gets through it all the way to the end of the war, actually, where Poland is just about demolished, and he's walking through the ruins. It's really an interesting film. Problem is if Polanski wins anything, he won't be able to come and get it without getting arrested, because he's still wanted for having sex with a minor many, many years ago. And because he was a coward and unwilling to face the consequences of his actions, I don't think a coward like that deserves to win anything, but he won't be able to come and get it anyway, because if he does, he'll get arrested and thrown in jail.
Still on the lam, you're saying?
Yeah, still on the lam. But the movie, I think, The Pianist, in a sense, it the more I think about it and see what else is out there, I think it's at least worthy to be up there for Best Picture, because it really does have that good, sprawling, epic sense, it's a man going through deep struggles, spiritual and psychological, as well as moral issues. So I think it definitely deserves it.
Now, there is a Best Actress nomination, Diane Lane, for a film that I think you have mentioned before on the air you found rather deplorable, and that is Unfaithful.
Yeah, and I think she deserves to be there for it, because she does do a brilliant job in that role. And I think that the story, actually, if it wasn't so gratuitous in its sexual scenes, it could have been a potentially good story about adultery. In other words, showing the wrongness of it and showing the need for people to take consequences for their actions. Because it kind of does that in the end of the story, but unfortunately, it titillates for, you know, 70% of the story is titillation of the sexual romance between these two characters. And ironically, it also shows, it tries to show some balance in that. A lot of times with these adultery movies, you know, they'll show that the partner is a total jerk, and so you at least understand why they engage in adultery. But in this case, Richard Gere is the husband in the movie, and in this case, he's actually a pretty good guy. There's nothing really wrong with him. So the idea of the movie is showing how, you know, how a person can be tempted to adultery even if they have an okay marriage, a good marriage. You don't just have to be in an unhappy marriage. You can be in a normal marriage, and there's a real truth to that, a real powerful truth to that. But again, I think that, unfortunately, it shows a way too much gratuity in its sexual scenes, unfortunately.
Okay, there's one little genre of films that I know. Actually, it's the highest-grossing genre of films ever in all of film history, and that is animated feature. They make more money. Most of the G-rated ones make more money than anything that's produced with live actors.
Yeah.
And there are several nominees here. I would like your opinion on a couple of these. First of all, Ice Age. It was one that I think Pixar probably put out. What did you think of the film?
I loved it. Unfortunately, it's the only one I saw of the ones that are up. I absolutely loved it, and I think it deserves to win. I know Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron, that was white man bad, Indian good movie.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, typical political correctness. And I heard Treasure Planet was pretty terrible. considering what it was. But that's all that I heard from other people I don't know.
Actually, Spirit was white man bad, Indian better, horses good.
Okay, yeah.
That's what it was, actually.
Yeah.
For that reason, my daughter loved it because she thinks horses
are
good, in spite of the fact that she's had experience with them and she knows they're nasty animals.
Sure.
Let's get your picks then. If we could run down the big categories, get your picks, and then I got a couple other questions for you, Brian.
Oh, man.
Best picture out of Chicago, Gangs of New York, The Hours, The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, and The Pianist, which would you be picking?
Definitely The Two Towers.
And
definitely.
What do you think will get it?
I do think that it could be The Two Towers or Chicago. But I have a fear that it will be Chicago, but I just hope it'll be Two Towers.
For the best actor, we've got Adrian Brody, Nicolas Cage, Michael Caine, Daniel Day-Lewis, we mentioned him before, and Jack Nicholson.
No doubt about it, Daniel Day-Lewis.
All right, and do you think that's one who will also get it?
Yes.
And then for best actress, Salma Hayek, Nicole Kidman, Diane Lane, Julian Moore, and Renee Zellweger, which one?
I would probably say that's going to be a close one and a tight one, but it'll probably... I think it should probably be Nicole Kidman or Diane Lane myself, but I think it might end up being Julianne Moore.
And why is that?
Well, because, again, it's from a very politically correct, agenda-driven movie, Far From Heaven. And is that the one that she's up for?
Far From Heaven, yeah.
Okay, or The Hours, either one. They're both the same sort of agenda. And I think that Hollywood is just so keyed in on that garbage that they definitely lean towards the politically correct and the left, you know, fanatic left-wing type stuff.
We're talking with Brian Godawa, screenwriter in Southern California and author of this book called Hollywood Worldviews, Watching the Movies with Wisdom and Discernment. We have a few more minutes left with him. I'll get his picks on the last two categories. But if you'd like to join us, our phone numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. For Best Supporting Actor, Chris Cooper, Ed Harris, Paul Newman, John C. Reilly, and Christopher Walken. What's your pick, and who do you think will get it?
I like Paul Newman. The person that will win it, I think it could be Paul Newman because he's sort of, you know, near the end of his career and his life. And, you know, there's oftentimes a sympathy in that. But if it's not him, it could be Christopher Walken, maybe.
And then, finally, for Best Supporting Actress, Kathy Bates, Julianne Moore, Queen Latifah, and Catherine Zeta-Jones. There's also Meryl Streep in there. How could we not have talked about Meryl Streep?
Yeah, really. Which, of course, I would probably pick her because I always pick her or Julianne Moore. You know, it probably will be Julianne Moore.
Now, there are a couple films that are coming out, that are slated to come out, and obviously neither of us have seen these, but I want to know what your expectations are. One movie we've discussed many times, that is The Matrix, has actually two sequels coming out this next year. They both were filmed at the same time. Apparently, they spent about 2 years in, I believe it was... Australia, major filming location, putting together this particular film, these two films, Revolution and
Reloaded.
Reloaded's coming out first, I believe. Yep. What are your expectations for these two films?
Well, I'm very interested to see how far they go. I've given many talks on this at churches and stuff about the finding God in The Matrix, and there's a lot of Christian imagery in the movie, but, you know, you have to beware. It's very much of a postmodern movie. They very deliberately are drawing from multiple religious traditions to craft the story. They're not trying to be Christians, and they've said that as much. So just be aware of that. And I'm just worried that it'll push away from the Christian imagery and go stronger towards, you know, the Buddhist imagery or the Greek Gnostic imagery that's in there. I'm hoping that it doesn't, but I'm just hoping that it doesn't, you know. But we'll see.
And the next installment of the trilogy, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, is due out. It's already been filmed. As far as I hear, most of it's been put in the can already. What do you think? What do you expect for
it? What can I say? You know, other than, you know, I get done watching Two Towers and I just dread the fact that I have to wait another year to see Return of the King. I mean, it's just like it's the highlight of the year, basically, you know. And I can't wait till they're all three available on DVD so that me and my friends can do like an all-day Saturday complete Lord of the Rings every other year, you know.
You know you're putting yourself squarely in the geek category by saying that.
Absolutely. Right up there with, by the way, I'll be doing that once a year, watching a complete 9-hour version of Lord of the Rings, and then the other half of the year I'll be going to my Pride and Prejudice party where we watch the 5-hour version of the British A&E with Colin Firth.
Oh, not only a geek but an Anglophile at the same time.
And a chick flick lover, I confess.
All right, out of the chick flick category is... what's expected to be, is there another Star Wars movie expected to come out here? I do want to know what you thought about the last one, because it's up at least for, this is episode 2, Attack of the Clones, for best visual effects against, of course, the Two Towers.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know. I gave up on Star Wars years ago, and mostly because of the story. It's just not, the story is just not good anymore. It's just, I think he's lost the whole spirit of the original, and he's gone into political concepts in there, and also just some of it just weak special effects driven stories rather than stories with special effects to back it up, and that's sort of been my opinion. So I'm not really looking forward to the next one. I'll see it because I have to, but I don't really care.
Have you seen Daredevil by any chance?
Yeah, I did. I just saw it last week.
This was supposed to be the next Spider-Man, although Daredevil is not as well-known a comic book character. Tell us about what you thought about
the movie. It was a pretty good movie. And, you know, I think because of Spider-Man now, people have seen the need to really give some more in-depth characterization of these heroes and give them some in-depth character and not keep them, you know, make them go beyond just the surface sort of action stuff. In other words, they're seeing the need for a good, strong story in these comic book movies, and I think Daredevil shows that in its story. Daredevil's a little darker than Spider-Man. He's more like a Batman. You know, he's got the dark side that he struggles with, and it's also got a darker feel and look to the whole film. You know, it was pretty good as comic book movies go. You know, I mean, I enjoyed it. And, you know, the theme deals with revenge, actually. And again, by the end of the story, the hero, Daredevil, chooses not to ultimately end up in vengeance because he recognizes that it's wrong and he wants to be a good guy, not a bad guy. So I think that's a good, strong moral message for everybody.
As you peruse this year's nominations, possible winners, as said on the backdrop of what's come before it and the general course of our culture, do you think film is getting better? You've said it is the high art form of the 21st century.
Absolutely.
Do you think it's getting better by way of the craft and by way of the message and story, or worse?
Well, I think it's sort of in some ways simultaneously better and worse. You know, I think it's getting better in terms of the craft, in terms of the ability to communicate powerfully through images and through better and better crafted stories and stronger, tighter acting and all that. I definitely see that myself. However, I mean, there is a sense in which our culture, I do think, is becoming obsessed with the darkness. And again, like that previous caller mentioned, there is a Nietzschean side to this that, you know, I do think that darkness is becoming very prevalent in a lot of these stories. It doesn't have to be elevated as good, but it just has to be almost necessary. A side to the story has to be dark. And that's sort of discouraging in some ways, because I think there's a place for that. But I think as a whole, the culture is becoming still more engrossed in violence, the need to have violence. You know, The Matrix is a good example of this. And even these other movies, Gangs of New York, and even the movie I said, Road to Redemption, you know, it seems like there has to be such excessive violence in order to make a point, because I think people feel like they need to push the envelope more and more in order to keep the attention of people. And that, of course, leads to the negative side of, you know, people worry about desensitization, but I mean, I'm more concerned about just the fact that you have to be dark and have to be violent in order to give it a serious edge, you know. And I mean, even Lord of the Rings is a pretty violent, dark movie, you know. The context of it, you know, of course, the ultimate theme is very redemptive, and again, there's a place for that, but I do think as a whole, we're going down that path a little too much sometimes.
Do you think we ought to be wary? I mean, if the skill and the craft of the filmmaker is increasing so that they are able to communicate even in subtle ways, their message. Is that something Christians who are in the marketplace of ideas and engaging the culture through its film should be wary of?
Sure, wary, but also I think it's just a... wary if it's a bad theme, but if it's a good theme, then not. You know, I mean, in a sense, I don't see a morality to it other than what morality it's being used in the service of. And so, the more subtle a movie is in being able to communicate its views and worldview, in a sense, the more effective it can be in connection with many other movies of the same theme. If you see one movie and it's a very subtle message, it's not likely to affect people too much. But the more and more of these movies and television shows have similar concepts and similar themes, and they're being subversive about it, then that's how people are changed without knowing it. You know, you're not going to watch a movie and walk out changing your view about things, but the more movies you watch that continue to reinforce a certain way of looking at the world without you realizing that they're doing that, the more effective they'll be in changing you without you recognizing it. So we need to be aware of how worldviews are communicated, not just because of the negative, you know, look at how bad Hollywood is trying to change us, but the good as well. There's a lot of good in there that we can see in movies that if you look closely, you can see there's a lot of good that's going on in these movies. Movies are a mixture of good and bad, and that's what I try to write about in my book, Hollywood Worldviews. I try to help the viewer discern the good from the bad.
With only 30 seconds here, how would you respond to the person who says, look, the Christian person who says, Hollywood is nothing but a smut factory. They are out to pollute our minds, our children, and our country. None of what is produced there is worth watching.
I would say that that's an extremist viewpoint that's really false. It's based on some truth, but it's ultimately false because the reality is Hollywood, as much as there is a spiritual conspiracy going on in this world or a worldview conspiracy, meaning people who believe the same way all often end up acting the same way, there's many contingents in the town that are not acting in correlation with each other. They just are acting similarly because they have the same worldview. And there are, I would say, send more Christians into the world of Hollywood to try to change it from within and consider it a mission field, you know, just like you would go into some native jungle to save the heathens. Well, Hollywood is the same way. Why don't you care about saving them? And especially since they do affect the world, change your view and see how you can be an agent for change in the world, not an agent for criticism and just attack.
Brian Gadawa, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Brian Gadawa is a screenwriter in Southern California. He's author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching the Movies with Wisdom and Discernment. By the way, folks, I will be giving away during the third hour of the program several copies of Brian's book Hollywood Worldviews for the best caller during open lines in the third hour of the program. Free copies, by the way. You won't have to pay for them. Just be the best callers during that third hour of open lines, and you can have Brian's book, Hollywood Worldviews, Watching the Movies with Wisdom and Discernment. Don't forget his website, Gadawa.com, Godawa.com. When we come back, we'll talk about the church growth movement, the pastor's role in evangelism with Pastor Rod Zwanitzer.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.